is Bill Tiller of Tiller.org. You're listening to BBSRadio.com. Don't forget to tune in to The Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr every Sunday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Enjoy.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness this week, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and I have a wonderful guest this week, Dr. Bill Tiller, and we're going to talk about his new book, the second book on psychoenergetics. How are you, Dr. Tiller?
I'm doing fine,
good.
Eva, and I guess it's the fourth book.
Oh, is it the fourth? I'm sorry.
That's all right. You don't have time to read them all. Some of them are kind of mathematical, but this one is not.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd understand the other one. Okay, just give us a brief rundown about you, and just so for my listeners, where you came from, how you got here, and what you're doing before we get started.
Well,
where to find you too?
Okay, I started out in Toronto, Canada. Did all my degree work there. Went to work as a advisory physicist at the Westinghouse Research Labs in Pittsburgh for 9 years. I got my wife to leave Canada and come to the U.S. with me. And after being at Westinghouse for 9 years, then went to Stanford as a full professor with tenure, fortunately, in 1964. My wife and I started daily meditation back around that time. And let's see, then I became department chair in our department because the man that hired me in became ill. And then when I went on sabbatical to London, to England, basically, in Oxford for 1970-71, I got seriously involved in psychoenergetics. It was an outgrowth of my early meditation, daily meditations, during the 60s, and I read this little book, Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain, by Ostrander and Schroeder. I knew a great deal about the work by that time, and yet I was impressed with the scope of the Soviet work and had this difficult question kept arising in me, which was, how might the universe be constructed to allow this crazy-seeming kind of stuff naturally coexist with the traditional physics I was doing at Stanford every day with my students? And although I had a certain mission to accomplish when I was there for that year, I couldn't get rid of this idea. And so I went and did a project of daily meditation, asking that question, and after 6 months, had a reasonably well-developed answer as to how this might happen. And I figured it was really important for someone serious and with a scientific background to work on this. And after thinking who it might be, I realized it had to be myself. And so when I came back to Stanford, I figured I had to do this. And so I gave up being department chair. I gave up all my professional committees and all my government committees in order to have enough time to do this in parallel with my traditional science. I had to feed my family, so I had to keep my day job. And so basically in 1971, I started a second path of my life and have maintained it ever since. And where I put this extra time was one-third was in the experiential development of self, which is a key process that is absolutely essential to come to an understanding of this seemingly strange stuff. The second third was in continuing the theorizing about the universe and how this other level of reality could interact with our traditional level of reality. And the third third was designing and conducting experiments to push the envelope and to keep the theory honest. And so I have been doing that ever since. And out of that have come these four books and now two DVDs. And your listeners, if they're interested, can see all about this on my website, tiller.org. And there we are.
Just Psychoenergetics is a new word, so why don't you tell us what you mean by that
before
we get going?
Well, okay, psychoenergetics. The foundation of that really began in the Soviet Union, and it was because the people who wanted to do work in that area had to make it seem and sound scientific rather than theological in order to actually have the freedom to work in that area. So psycho, of course, is of the psyche, and energy is the energetics. So basically it dealt with energies and therefore made it palatable to the Soviet masters. But of the psyche, of the human. And, of course, there were manifestations of great human capabilities, you know, levitation, mind reading, precognition, healing, etc., etc. So that all these things are associated with the human psyche and with consciousness, human consciousness. And the here is where the separation comes in between traditional science, and psychoenergetic science. In traditional science, you could write an equation on a blackboard, which is mass with arrows back and forth to energy. And pretty much all the work that traditional science has done for the last 400 years could be encapsulated in that metaphor. And the connection between the mass and energy is Einstein's E equals mc squared. And since the days of Descartes, the unstated assumption in science has been that no human qualities of consciousness, intention, emotion, mind, or spirit can significantly influence a well-designed target experiment in physical reality. So psychoenergetics flies in the face of that unstated assumption, which may have been correct in those old days, but it's certainly not correct now. And psychoenergetics then expands that, we'll call it a metaphorical equation, where now we have mass with arrows back and forth to energy, and arrows back and forth to information, and arrows back and forth to consciousness. Go ahead.
I have to ask this question because I know there are some scientists listening, some of them from ICEM and Council Grove. When you say consciousness, can that be replaced with awareness, or do you mean the energy of all there is?
I think something remarkably different than the present dictionary word for consciousness as awareness or awakeness.
Okay.
To me, the problem with the word consciousness is that none of us have come to an agreed-upon definition of the term, and perhaps it is because the term is basically so broad. For me, for example, I think of consciousness, human consciousness, as a byproduct of spirit entering dense matter,
mm-hmm.
which is us.
Yes.
Now, probably better not to ask the question of what consciousness is at this point in time because we know so little about it. So let's just ask the question of what does consciousness do? And as soon as you do that, you immediately realize that consciousness manipulates information. Information in the form of a set of numbers to make sums and dividends and multiplicands, etc., or the integration of, let's say you have a tabletop with a bunch of letters separated on the tabletop, and they're all a jumble, but you rearrange them in the form of words, and the words in the form of a sentence so that it has meaning, and you see you've produced a great deal of order, and the order has meaning, and that is information. We find we do the same thing if we collect a set of symbols and put them into master equations that drive our present engineering and our science. Or it can be the kind of thing you do on a lovely Sunday afternoon. You pull a box down from the shelf, and it's a jigsaw puzzle. And you arrange these oddly formed pieces, often into some of the most beautiful pictures. Mm-hmm. That's creating information out of disorder. Now, we've known for 60 years, at least 60 years, that a process in nature that increases the information content actually produces a decrease in the entropy of the universe. And you can simply think of this as creating more order. Well, that's important, and there is a mathematical equation connecting these two. Now, we've known for 150 years that it is the thermodynamic free energy process in nature that drives all the processes, all the things we've ever learned. They're due to a change in the thermodynamic free energy. And when you look at that thermodynamic free energy function, it has in it three main terms. First one is pressure volume. Second one is plus the energy, internal energy. And the third is plus, or actually it's minus, temperature times the entropy. Now, in the old days, we used the pressure volume term to drive steam engines. And today we use them to drive compressors for refrigerators and other such things. The energy term, we know, general public knows it most commonly when we accelerate fundamental particles in special reactors and drive them into particular materials to create a kind of micro explosion in which all kinds of particles come out. And we learned a great deal about fundamental particles in nature over the last 75 years from this kind of work. So that's a real bashing of things together. In the last term, this temperature times entropy, if the entropy is constant but the temperature differs, well, you can get geothermal energy out of the Earth by a temperature difference between the surface and something deep down. And we're doing that in order to make as an energy resource. And the other one is where the temperature is constant now and there is a change in the entropy driven by the increase of information in the process. And here, one might go into a deep meditative state and invoke the physical vacuum or deeper levels of the vacuum and invite nature to reveal itself in special ways. And that changes the thermodynamic driving force so that the process can go on in the physical vacuum that reveals to us more about the nature of nature. So that's psychoenergetics. It deals with these things largely in the human psyche because the human psyche now can drive processes in the human. It can, by working on this within self, to become inner self-managed at the more subtle levels. Produces a kind of order within oneself. And as one does, one increases the thermodynamic free energy in the universe. One restores the potential that drives our world. And one can do this kind of thing by intention, by directed, focused intention. And one can change from a normal individual to an adept. And if one continues that, one can convert from being an adept to being a master. And if one continues doing that, one can change from being a master to being an avatar. So there is huge potential in the future for humanity, for us to do this inner work within ourselves and evoke changes at the vacuum level of reality so as to do many, many things, to make us more and more capable, to create new technologies, to change the errors we've made in our world from the past perspective, the traditional science perspective, etc. So all of this is related to consciousness. We're really just starting to come into a world where our consciousness can deal with other levels of reality and have very big effects. The effect of consciousness in our present electric atom molecule world are basically fairly small because of the form of the equation that connects information and entropy, information change and entropy change. So it's all about changes.
I want to make sure I understand you.
Okay.
So that the average person, so if I'm wrong in what I'm about to say, be sure and tell me. Or what you're trying to say is that by becoming in an altered state of mind and placing focused attention, that people can affect physical reality and heal themselves or change their path, change the things that's happening in their lives and be more creative and successful?
All of the above.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure.
The issue is that the things you focus on with sustained intention is what you become.
Okay.
Now, our experimental work, as you know, related, or the most the work of the last 10 years, dealt with, all right, let me go back one step. I took this unstated assumption back in 1997 that no human consciousness, intention, emotion, mind, or spirit could significantly influence the target experiment in physical reality. This has been the unstated assumption of science since the days of Descartes. And so I asked myself, I don't think that's true, but let's do the experiment. Let's do serious experiments to see, in our present world, is that still true? Was it ever true? I don't know, but was it still true? And so we designed four separate, unique experiments, well-designed, well-monitored, and we had them running, and they give traditional electric atom molecule physical results that we're all familiar with, at least all the scientists are familiar with. And then we added intention to the picture. Now, I didn't do it via using humans, because that had been done before, but humans are basically not reliable at this stage of their development. They can't sustain and replicate exactly the same level of intention all the time. So I went through two steps. The first step was to take a simple electronic circuit, little black box, if you like, and from a deep meditative state, had four people go into the deep meditative state, and a specific intention for one of the experiments would be stated and then held by all four.
Were they at the same time or separate?
All at the same time. We're doing a black box in which we're going to embed human intention to affect a particular experiment. So there are four experiments. There eventually are going to be four black boxes. The black boxes are all the same. Okay, but the thing that's embedded in them from a deep meditative state is a specific intention. And what you do is you take that particular black box into the room where the experiment is being run, place it about a foot or two from the experiment, plug it into the wall socket, and turn it on. Its electrical output power is less than 1/1,000,000th of a watt. So very, very small electric power. The frequency of the output radiation is in the 1 to 10 million hertz range. So it's called a microwave range, but very, very weak. And what we tend to see, and we did see for these four unique experiments, was that there would be a slow change from the background. And when I say slow, nothing much happened for about the first month. And then the property measurements started to change, always in the direction of the intention. And it would rise, and after maybe another month, it would start to plateau. And generally plateaued very much in the level of the specific intention. And we found we could do this. We could take water. Let me just give an example of purified water. And increase its pH, which is the acid-alkaline balance of the water, by one full pH unit. Now, one pH unit is a lot for a biological system. If we were doing this in the human body, let's say the blood, and we increased it a half a pH unit or decreased it a half a pH unit, the human would be dead or dying. So for a biological system, one full pH unit is a very great deal.
Mm-hmm.
The intention was to do this with no chemical additions, and the water is just in equilibrium with air. And we were remarkably successful with this. The next experiment, let me just finish this one before we go on to the others. But the next experiment is to take the same water, and the intention in the black box was to reduce the pH by one full pH unit with no chemical additions. And again, it's in equilibrium with air. So, and we were very successful with that. And we can do it with all kinds of water. So that's a remarkable outcome. We're changing the chemistry of the system. It's a little more complex than that. I'll come to that later. So you were going to ask something.
I was going to ask, how long did it take to place the intention? How long did the people...
Generally, we do it twice. A full cycle might be a half an hour.
Uh-huh.
And I generally always like to do a repeat. So it takes an hour to an hour and a half. And we, our experience is that we can do maybe four of these a day.
Mm-hmm.
And we're pretty tired at the end. But in essence, that's sort of a timeline, at least with the kind of devices that we had. They're not as good as the devices I want to make, but they were sufficient to do these four experiments and to replicate one of them around the world.
Now, can anyone do this, Bill, or do they have to get in an altered state? And what I mean by that is a very cohesive, focused state.
Yeah. Well, I haven't, of course, studied that. I'll leave that for others. But basically, everyone has the capability, the internal capability to do it. But in our case, all four people were well-accomplished meditators.
Okay.
In the sense that they could go into a deep state and hold it and sustain it for a long period of time with a specific intention and with specific visualization. That takes practice, generally, to do that. And my feeling always was that the unseen does the heavy lifting. I mean, I've asked many really great healers what is special about their abilities, and they generally say, I don't particularly do anything, Bill. I just try to be as clear a channel as I can for the universe to work through me. And so we try to do just that kind of thing. And you can feel the connection with the unseen. And that was most remarkable for us when I wanted to do 10 at once, to do the simplest kind of experiment. I was doing it with Norm Shealy. And we wanted to do it with 10 subjects. And when we imprinted these 10, we did them all at once. So we stacked them up on the table, hooked them all up together, and did it. And during that meditation, the energy flow through us, which it just was absolutely palpable. It was so strong, there could be no doubt that something was working through us into this world.
I believe you. And what about the repeatability that you've had happen around the world?
Okay, that's really interesting. We selected first four sites in this country, and the people that put up half the money for the work wanted there to be a control site at within 2 to 20 miles of the local sites. Pardon me, I should say there were five sites. I had forgotten our Payson Lab site. Later on, there were two additional sites, one in London and one in Milan, Italy. But initially, we picked three sites, and one was Payson, one was in Missouri, and one was in Kansas. There were two other U.S. sites, one in Bethesda and one in Baltimore. And the Baltimore site was at NIH, and Bethesda site was in the Uniformed Services Hospital. So the first thing we did, as I say, was with the three sites. And we provided equipment that was shipped to them directly from the manufacturing center, and purified water that was shipped to them from Fisher Scientific. We told them how to set it up. We, in fact, showed them. And they ran background data for about 3 months. And we were convinced they knew what to do. We had them ship us diskettes of their data streams. We were measuring three parameters. One was pH, one was air temperature, one was water temperature. And another actually turned out to be the electrode voltage. So they shipped us their diskettes, and we, by snail mail. We didn't want there to be much digital interaction. And we then would send them back plots of the pH with time.
I missed something. The diskettes. What does the
These are all computer monitored.
Okay.
And so the information streams go on to a diskette. All these data streams are fed into a computer, and then the computer puts that on a diskette, and every couple of weeks we would exchange diskettes, put in a new diskette, and they would send us by snail mail the old diskette. So that's sort of how it worked. And at the end of the 3 months, we then delivered them a black box, which was to increase the pH by one full pH unit. That is, one black box for each of the three stations that were running the background. And what we saw was exactly what I described earlier. We plugged it in, turned it on. Nothing much was seen in the first month, and then it started to change. And we picked the example of the pH increasing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would see the measured pH going up, and we would see that it plateaued. If we took the device away before it plateaued, it would just slowly decay over several months. But if we let it go to the plateau level, which something like 2 to 3 months later, then the measurements thereafter, at least for a couple of years that we continued looking at it, would be at this upper level. So it was a very, very interesting and very successful result. Now, the thing that was strange was that at our control sites, which had exactly the same equipment, but it didn't have this black box, we got the same results. Now, that was really strange. And I now have to go back to a first observation. You know, after our first imprinting of one of these black boxes with the water pH going up, and basically the different people visualize it differently. My wife was one of the sitters, as I was, and we had another couple. My wife visualized it like a thermometer going up. And she held that. In any event, we found right after we had done that, I put an unimprinted device and an imprinted device about 100 meters away from each other. And I turned them both off electrically. Okay? So nothing should happen, right? Wrong. It turns out that within 3 to 5 days, the unimprinted device had picked up the imprint from the imprinted device. And I was shocked, dismayed. I realized that I wouldn't be able to do the kind of experiments I wanted to do because these two had somehow become entangled with each other, and the imprint transfers, so we've lost our control. Well, two things then occurred to me. One is, holy moly, here we have evidence that there is at least one other communication channel in the universe whereby information could be transferred from one thing to another.
Mm-hmm.
That's remarkable. And the second was, I have got to find a way to keep the imprint intention in the device for long enough to do experiments and have others do experiments. And I found, I reasoned that, well, maybe electromagnetism is involved. So what I did is I wrapped the device in aluminum foil, and then I put it, that would block out all the optical range information, and I then put it in a small electrically grounded Faraday cage, which would block out all of the gigahertz, megahertz, radio wave electromagnetics down to about 1,000 hertz. couldn't do much below that because it takes too much copper shielding. But when I did that, I found then that I could keep the imprint intention in the device for the order of 3 months.
Wow, that's amazing to me.
Yeah. So that meant that we really could do experiments and we could have other people do experiments.
Now, what, and, did you ever fool with using magnetisms or polarity?
We've tried many, many things. Nothing shields this radiation, really.
And would it push it harder if you used magnetism?
We have done experiments where we have built a magnetically shielded box 5 feet cube and do experiments in it. We use mu metal shielding, and inside we use thick mu metal containers, and this energy just goes right through.
Okay.
Doesn't shield.
Go ahead.
No. I mean, the issue is that was remarkable, and what it means is it's just like the experiment I did with an unimprinted device and an imprinted device 100 meters apart that electrically turned off.
So it doesn't have to be turned on to work?
They're entangled. And so the point is that the control sites, 2 to 20 miles away, they were information entangled with the black box site. All right? So I call these IIEDs, intention imprinted electrical devices. So we thought, okay, we know now that it isn't just 100 meters, but it's 2 to 20 miles that they can be information entangled. So I decided, let's use the Baltimore and Bethesda sites as control sites for these three Payson, Missouri, Kansas sites with the IIEDs. And so we had the Baltimore and Bethesda sites run background with never one of these IIEDs there in that location, at least at that time. And we found that after 2 months, the pH at those sites had gone up about 0.85 pH units. And there never was one of these devices there. So that says the information entanglement extends over something of the order of 1,500 miles. And then I had interaction with a young group of scientists in London and another young group of scientists in Milan, Italy. I never had met these folks, but they wanted to get involved and do something. And so I said, okay, why don't you purchase this equipment and set it up this way and run background? Well, the English site went online first, and within 3 weeks, with no black box there, the pH went up one full pH unit.
Wow.
And then 3 months later, the Milan site went online, and within 1 week, the pH had gone up one pH unit, and within 3 weeks, it had gone up 1.7 pH units.
So then I looked back
at the old data, and the control site in Missouri had also gone up 1.7 pH unit, and it was below ground. And then I looked at the data much more carefully, and the sites where the pH unit had gone up 1.7 pH units were both below ground. The Milan one was in a basement. And the sites that had gone up one pH unit, they were all at ground level. And the Baltimore and Bethesda sites were three stories up in the air, and they went up about 0.85 pH units. So it seemed to suggest that whatever this energy is, it prefers to go through the ground than through the air. Electromagnetism prefers to go through the air than through the ground. That was interesting.
Would that mean that it has something to do with the magnetism then in the Earth?
Perhaps, but basically, I did an experiment that related to magnetism in a very important way. Because this one, all of these things I've mentioned are just sort of the first phase. The second phase of the work was to try to figure out what was going on, what was happening, why was this sort of thing happening, what was the different physics, if there was different physics, and we had noticed that there were three characteristic signatures associated with this experiment, or these experiments. And the first one was this information entanglement that I just talked about. Because now we see that the information entanglement are between macroscopic sites, like a laboratory of 10,000 cubic feet and another laboratory 6,000 miles away of the order of 1,000 cubic feet, and all at room temperature. Well, this is very, very different than quantum entanglement, but it's a real phenomenon with a range of at least 6,000 miles. So it's definitely not electromagnetism. It's something else.
Another level of reality.
Another level of reality, another aspect of reality. The telling experiment for me was one where we did use a magnet. We put underneath the vessel, a little cylindrical jar that holds the water, and we have the measurement instruments coming in at the top. And underneath it, we put a disc magnet, one of these little ceramic magnets, well, a big ceramic magnet in this case, maybe a diameter of 2 inches and maybe about a quarter of an inch thick, and we stuck it exactly under the jar, centrally symmetric, and we left one of the pole, the north pole, let's say, up for 3 to 5 days, and then we just turned it over and left the south pole up for 3 to 5 days and measured continuously. Now, if you do that experiment in our normal electric atom molecule level of reality, you don't see any difference. And that's because in our normal level of reality, there are only magnetic dipoles. To get this kind of effect, the effect we got, which was we found the south pole strongly increased the pH, became more alkaline, and the north pole strongly decreased the pH, it became more acidic. And the difference after about 3 days, and these are little magnets of maybe 100 Gauss to 500 Gauss, very much like the ones you put on your refrigerator. Mm-hmm. So it's a very small field, relatively speaking. Large still compared to the Earth, because the Earth's magnetic field is a half a Gauss. So larger than that, but people are doing experiments these days at a million Gauss, many millions of Gauss. So in any event, we saw this difference with the DC magnetic with polarity. And that cannot occur in our normal reality because with dipoles, the magnetic force and the magnetic energy are independent of the polarity. You can turn the magnet around and you've got the same energy and the same magnetic force. But here we saw a difference. And so it says that a kind of magnetism is important in this new phenomena, and it can't be dipole. The only way you get this kind of effect is if you have monopoles or an odd number of single poles, that is south or north. So that became truly important at a fundamental level. And so, indeed, now we come to the point you were starting to make. That is, we have accessed another level of reality, and I will call it another level of physical reality, because our subsequent work indicates that it comes from the physical vacuum. That is, the vacuum level of reality, in my modeling and description, occurs in the space between the fundamental particles that make up the atoms. If you take the old classical picture of electrons taking orbits around a nucleus, mm-hmm. most of the volume of the atom is empty space. The particles take up very little space, and their orbits take up very little space.
Right.
So all of that other space is the vacuum. Like the kind of thing you have in outer space,
mm-hmm.
or better than that, but still, that's the issue. So it's this kind of thing is coming from the vacuum level of reality. And so let's suppose that I'm correct, that we've touched a magnetic monopole level of reality. I call it magnetic information wave level of reality. And suppose we could turn that up just by turning a dial. That is the strength of it. When it's not turned up, okay, the electrons just go take their orbits, and they just go on and on and on and on in the same way. But as you turn it up, you pass a critical place where now you'll start to see a change in the locus of the electrons in their orbits. And if you turn it up higher, you'll see a greater divergence. And you turn it up higher still, you'll see even more. So what you see is the effect of an attractor, which is the way traditional physics talks about what is going on in the universe with dark energy and dark matter. The dark matter is acting like an attractor. They don't see it directly, but they see its effect on other electric atom molecule stuff, like planets and so on. So now we come to the resultant of all of our experiments, and that is that we have discovered that there are two unique levels of physical reality. And physical reality is, I think, let me not go there yet. And one of them is the electric atom molecule level, and the second one is the magnetic information wave level. So that any property measurement, let's call a magnitude Q sub M, meaning measurement, it's equal to Q sub little e, which means the electric atom molecule level, or the normal thing we see in a laboratory experiment of this kind, plus alpha effective, which is a coupling coefficient, times Q sub little m. And Q sub little m is this magnetic information wave level, which functions in the physical vacuum. And alpha effective is the coupler between these two. Normally, under normal conditions, these are uncoupled, these two levels of reality. So all we get is the electric atom molecule stuff. That's the typical stuff that traditional science measures in its laboratory every day.
Mm-hmm.
But through the use of consciousness in this device, which is switched on in the environment, something coming out of the device, which is really the coupler material, comes out and fills the room and fills the instruments so that now there becomes a coupling, so that the instruments now can begin to access this other stuff, this magnetic stuff. Without this coupler substance, which is related to our embedding the intention in the device and the unseen universe doing something also with that device, which relates to this coupler stuff, we wouldn't see those results. But we do see them, and we see them every time. We see them in the replication experiments, because we've also discovered a way to measure the effect of this device. That is, we were able to see the excess thermodynamic free energy for the proton, which is really the hydrogen ion when you're making pH measurements. What you're measuring there is you're measuring the H plus ion, essentially. And so what I was able to do was to expand our normal thermodynamics to include this next term, which was like a magnetic monopole term and a magnetic potential brought about by this process. And when I did that, we found that experimentally we could analyze the pH measurement data. We could tell when we depart from normal reality in pH terms, and we could measure how far we were departed or how far the space was elevated with respect to this new thermodynamic potential. And we could measure it, and we measured it for all 10 sites involved in our replication experiment. Even though we had never been there, it was all in the diskettes of the information. And now, of course, we're doing experiments that way all the time to see the effects of human biofields and such on a room. A room can be converted into a sacred space, just like in some European cathedral, by humans. We found, when we looked more deeply, we found that humans have their acupuncture meridian chakra system at this couple level of reality. So the couple, let me go back to the kind of equation I tried to write on this imaginary blackboard, that Q sub capital M is equal to QE plus alpha effective Q sub little m. When alpha effective is close to zero, then that's our normal reality, and all you get is the QE part of the equation. But using consciousness, and this shows that consciousness is so very much different than awareness. okay? Because mm-hmm. you, with the consciousness embedded in the device, alpha effective increases from about zero. And it increases to a level where now we produce coupling. So we go from the uncoupled state of physical reality where these two kinds of universes are there, but they can't interact with each other. But with consciousness, they can begin to interact with each other, and because you see the property measurements change. And so that's an effect of consciousness in the form of human intention and maybe something else
we got
on
about
the reality.
10 minutes, and I have a couple of questions here.
Sure.
I want to ask this first. Jim Beal, I don't know if you remember him.
I know Jim,
Jim
quite well.
He's here with me tonight.
Oh, good. Hi, Jim.
He's spending the weekend with me. And so I have a question, a couple of questions for him, but then I want you to tell me, since you answer his questions, what this means to mankind.
Okay.
But his question, you know, he's really into EMF fields. And
right.
He wants to know, would EMF fields affect the ability of the intender or the device?
My response is that there is a reaction equation that occurs between electromagnetism and magnetoelectrism. Magnetoelectrism is this magnetic charge moving to create electric fields, just like electromagnetism is electric charge moving to create magnetic fields. So, but they're quite different. They have a different kind of, it's a different photon that's involved in the process. It has to be. We can easily shield electromagnetism. We have no capability yet to shield magnetoelectrism.
What about the pulsing of EMF fields? Is that what you're talking about and I just don't understand?
Well, no. I mean, I'm not... It doesn't have to be pulse fields, but basically I expect a similar kind of thing to occur in the general sense with magnetoelectrism, and we're doing experiments to learn about that, versus electromagnetism. The way Jim should begin to look at this is to think of a normal electrodynamic circuit, all right? And we know that if it's a transformer, you can put in a secondary circuit and you can change the voltage and current relationship that occurs when you do that. Well, in this case, you take the analog electric circuit of our traditional electric atom molecule reality, and when you produce coupling, it's just like introducing a magnetoelectric circuit where the elements in the secondary circuit or the second circuit are just opposite to what they are in the electric circuit. That is, a resistor is probably still a resistor of some kind, but a capacitor, which is electric charge storage, it'll be magnetic charge storage in the other level. And an inductor at the electric level will be a capacitor in the magnetoelectric circuit. So you can begin to see the coupling produce interactive changes, but it's not straightforward. There are lots of things to learn, and we're about trying to learn those things. But that's the way I presently am looking at this coupling. We found with humans that if you do a kinesiological study for various kinds of points in the body, then if you bring, and we use the world-class kinesiologists, if you bring just a bar magnet into the near field, then we found that the south pole strengthened that particular muscle and the north pole weakened that muscle. So since it's a DC magnetic field polarity effect, it says that the human body, and probably all humans and maybe all vertebrates, has a system in their bodies that is at the coupled level of reality. And the coupled level of reality is a higher thermodynamic free energy state, which means it can drive all processes at our normal electric atom molecule level. And that is the uncoupled state. And most of the human body is at that level. Otherwise, our biology and our medicine wouldn't be the way it is. So that's particularly interesting. And then when you look at muscles, it turns out there are proprioceptors in muscles, and there's a very weak kind of coupling between proprioceptors and the acupuncture meridian system. And, of course, the acupuncture meridian system is connected to the chakra system. So it allows higher dimensional energies to come through into the acupuncture meridian system because it's at the couple level of reality. Human intention can influence it, and then you can get Qigong masters to pump energy into the normal electric atom molecule level of the body, and therefore affect both biology and human health. So all humans ultimately can do this kind of thing, if they work at it. You know, it requires training like any athlete.
Mm-hmm. It opens the door to some new free energy.
Yes.
And we've got about 3 or 4 minutes.
Let me give you an idea of what's available. For quantum mechanics and relativity theory to be internally self-consistent, people like Wheeler and others calculated that the vacuum, the physical vacuum, had to contain an energy density of about 10 to the 94 grams equivalent per cc. That's a huge amount of energy, but let's put it in terms we can understand. Let's do two particular calculations. One is we know the mass density everywhere in the universe. The astronomers have worked that out, and we can get a kind of average mass density. So we could multiply that average mass density by the volume of the universe. Let's take a sphere 15 billion light years in radius, okay? And we multiply it by the average mass density, so that gives us how much mass there is in the cosmos that we know of. And you multiply each gram by E equals mc squared. So that gives the total amount of energy stored in the mass of our universe. On the other hand, let's take a calculation of just a single hydrogen atom. It has a radius of about 10 billionths of a centimeter. And we calculate the volume. It's something of the order of 10 to the minus 24 cubic centimeters, a very small number. But we multiply that now by the 10 to the 94 grams per cc that's supposed to be in the vacuum. And when you get that sum and you compare the two, what you see is that the energy, the vacuum energy storage in the single hydrogen atom is a trillion times that of all of the mass energy stored in our cosmos. So now you can begin to see some idea of what kind of potential energy, and perhaps, well, I think will become available energy as we go forward in our evolution. And we'll see how important the vacuum and the understanding of the vacuum is to us. That's our future.
Oh, I wish we had 3 more hours, Bill.
Well, it'll take more than that, but it's a good start.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. I want to see if I can get with you and finish up these list of 50 questions I have.
I understand. It's good that you have all these questions. But
thank you, Bill.
One point is that our discussion tonight shows you that consciousness is a hell of a lot more than awareness.
Yes, yes.
Okay. Lots of love.
Thank you. And Tiller.org, everybody.
Tiller.org, everybody.
Tiller.org.
Okay.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.